Hello, is this Josh?
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is Donald. How are you?
You are terrifically prompt. Thank you.
I'm sitting here watching the clock ticking by. I'm all ready to go.
I can hear those two little minds ticking away. Go ahead.
So, welcome to the Broadway Radio Show.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk about several things. One, we were going to talk about your one-man show called Call My Publicist. Which I know you have a performance coming up in a few months. But I think we want to start telling our listeners a little bit about your background, where you came from, and how you got into the whole publicist, press agent field to begin with.
Okay. Is this the interview where we...
This is the interview. This,
oh, we're doing
we're
it
rolling.
Right now. Okay,
yeah, we're rolling.
And then we're rolling. Okay.
Yeah, we're
great.
Rolling.
Okay. I grew up in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And was lucky enough to be a town that had what were then called pre-Broadway tryouts.
Right.
So my experience of going to the theater were things like seeing Lucille Ball in Wildcat, Vivian Leigh in Tavarish, B. Lilly and Tammy Grimes in High Spirits, Robert Preston and Ben Franklin in Paris. So, and Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl.
Mm-hmm.
So we had quite a lot going on there in Philadelphia. It was really hot. So when I came to New York to see shows, it was always about catching up with the shows that didn't try out in Philadelphia. And it all happened in terms of like falling in love with the theater and wanting to be a press agent, or wanting to be in the professional theater, not just being a person who watches it. Was seeing the original production of Hello, Dolly! At the St. James Theater in 1964. And it was a combination of waiting in line to get standing room tickets, which they sold at 10 o'clock in the morning, seeing the show, and then going backstage and meeting Carol Channing in her dressing room in an era when going backstage was not a big deal. There
right.
were no barricades.
Mm-hmm.
You could just... You know, I was just 15 years old. I mean, I didn't know anybody in the business, and just was able to go back into her dressing room and seeing her in her Dolly makeup, because it was between a matinee and evening. She stayed in makeup but was wearing a terry cloth robe, and I thought, oh my goodness gracious, that her Dolly makeup close-up was just more thrilling than anyone could imagine.
Well, Horace, it looks as if there's nothing more for me to say, but... Goodbye, 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 goodbye. Don't try and stop me, Horace, please. Wave your little hand and whisper so long, dearie, you ain't gonna see me anymore. But when you discover that your life is dreary, don't you come a-knocking on my door. 'Cause I'll be all dolled up and singing that song that says, you dog, I told you so. So wave your little hand and whisper so long, dearie. Dearie should have said so long ago. Because you treated me so rotten and rough, I've had enough of feeling low. So wave your little hand and whisper so long, dearie. Dearie should have said so long, so long ago. For I can hear that choo-choo calling me on to a fancy new address. Yes, I can hear that choo-choo calling me on board that happiness express. I'm gonna learn to dance and drink and smoke a cigarette. I'm going as far away from Yonkers as a girl can get. And on those cold winter nights, Horace, you can snuggle up to your cash register. It's a little lumpy, but it rings. Don't don't come a knocking, I'll be all dolled up and singing that song that says you're dog. I told you so. So, Horace, you will find your life a sad old story when you see your dolly shuffle off to glory. Oh, I should have said so long.
Right there and then at that matinee that I wanted to be part of the Broadway community, but I had no idea where it would fit in. And then I went to Villanova University and got a master's degree. And through our playwright in residence, David Rabe, and his connection to Joseph Papp, I met Joe, and Joe introduced me to his press agent, Bob Allman, and Bob Allman got me my first two jobs in New York. And so my very first Broadway show that I worked on as an apprentice Broadway press agent was Sleuth.
Oh, okay.
And my first apprentice musical was Mac and Mabel.
Oh, terrific. Wow.
So it was a pretty heady experience.
And so, and obviously you had a very, very long career, but I thought, I mean, I know you have, I know you tell a lot of stories in your one-man show, which we don't want to spoil for our listeners, but if you can kind of go through, what was it like working on Mac and Mabel? It was your first musical. You've got Preston, you've got Bernadette Peters, you've got Jerry Herman, you've got, I mean, it's an amazing group of people, and you're just an apprentice at this point.
Right. Well, first, since we are actually doing the interview and you haven't mentioned the full title of the show, I'm going to do that.
Yes, do that.
And it's called Call My Publicist, The Starry Education of a Broadway Press Agent.
Mm-hmm.
And the shows I'm going to be doing are at United Solo Festival in New York City in September.
Oh, great. And people can find tickets online.
Oh, my goodness, yes, yes. As Carol Channing would say, yes. It's just 212-239-6200, and that's how you get Teletrudge tickets.
Oh, okay, great. But you also, and you also have a website where people can track you down and find out more information.
callmypublicist.com,
which we will put up on the website, on the radio show website, so people can link to that.
Okay, Mac and Mabel. For first of all, we do not have Robert Preston and Bernadette Peters because, as I talk about in the show, Bernadette Peters did not enter the picture until 3 weeks into this show's progress.
Mm-hmm.
So we went through two Mabels in two weeks. So, the experience to me was the thrill of being in the same room with so many of the people who had created Hello, Dolly.
Right.
First and foremost, our producer, David Merrick, director, choreographer, Gower Champion, composer, lyricist, Jerry Herman, and book writer, Michael Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be in the same room with them was astonishing, and to hear songs that you had never heard before, you know, what is it like when your ears first hear movies or movies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, look what's happened to Maypole. I mean, time heals everything. It's extraordinary to be in the room while it's happening and watch the process of it being created. And I was scared out of my wits because I was so scared of David Merrick, who I knew was famous for firing people, and I didn't want to get fired from my very first David Merrick show.
Movies were movies when you paid a dime to escape, cheering the hero and hissing the man in the cape. Romance and action and thrills, partner, there's gold in them hills. Movies were movies when during the titles you'd know you'd get a happy ending, dozens of blundering cops in a thundering chase, getting a bang out of lemon meringue in the face. Bandits attacking a train, one little tramp with a cane. Movies were movies when I ran the show. were movies when Pauline was tied to the track. After she trudged through the ice with the babe on her back, girls at the seashore would stand all in a row in the sand, rolling their stockings an inch and a quarter below the line of decency, and Swanson and Keaton and Dressler and William S. Hart. No one pretended that what we were doing was art. We had some guts and some luck, but we were just making a buck. Movies were movies when I ran the show. Art. No one pretended that what we were doing was art. We had some guts and some luck, but we were just making a buck. Movies were movies when I ran the show.
So you joined Mac and Mabel right at the very, very beginning, and
very beginning. If you're the apprentice, that means you go to the first rehearsal. Mm-hmm. You're not invited back very frequently to see much more, and then it goes out of town, which I had nothing to do with, so I didn't get to see it again until it was trying out in Washington.
Uh-huh. So you did. So it's interesting though, because you did get to see the development of the show, and you got to see, you know, the changes that were being made and the ups and downs, and then ultimately the New York opening.
Yes.
And that's
my favorite part of working on any show, page mm-hmm. to stage.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the press agent gets a script, and frequently we would get cassettes of something that was like a demo.
Right.
Of the music. But to actually be there when they're adding, you know, first you watch it just being read around the table, and then you see it get on its feet, and then if you're lucky you can get to the Zitzprobe where you hear the orchestrations for the first time. So there's a progress about it, you know, that all of those steps are thrilling to observe.
And what was Merrick like?
Well, he's a large part of my show.
Yeah.
And he was a master manipulator of people and the press.
Mm-hmm.
What's been a fascinating experience working on my show is how much the show changed, not because I changed a line of it, but because we are now so much more keenly aware of media manipulation,
mm-hmm.
of international ramifications, and to see how someone can in fact manipulate the media, as Merrick frequently did. And just had a very good time scaring the media and scaring people who worked on the shows. I mean, we lived in constant fear on one side, but the other part was the fact that he really knew every angle of the business. He was not a dilettante.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mac and Mabel was his 79th Broadway production.
Right.
So we're talking about somebody who totally and completely gets it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the wonderful part, because working with a total pro, I mean, you can do two things. You can just hide and not want to be part of it, or you jump into it with both feet and say, I'm really going to learn from this man, and he was an amazing teacher for me.
Oh, that's great.
And that's pretty much the emphasis of the show is not, I work with this person.
Right.
What did I learn from the people with whom I worked?
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine, I mean, as you said, there's been so much written about Merrick, you know, and obviously a lot of it is slanted relatively negatively because of his reputation for, you know, how difficult he could be to work with. But as you point out, and I totally agree, the man was an absolute master at production. I mean, as you said, he understood every aspect of the business, and he was a brilliant producer on Broadway. He was brilliant.
I have to bring your listeners to the attention of the liner notes for the new Bette Midler Hello Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, clearly Scott Rudin has been inspired by David Merrick in every aspect of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But the liner notes by Stephen Susskind really show in enormous detail how David Merrick crafted Hello Dolly to be the show that it became.
Right.
And you see it step after step after step, after who he hired, how he got this number in, how he got this number out, how he shaped it, you know, how he molded it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's producing.
Right. And I think, we don't see producers of that level very much these days. I think Scott Rudin is a good example of one who has jumped,
Cameron McIntosh.
Yeah,
they're few in number.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on from Mac and Mabel, because that's your first apprentice job on a musical. When did you become a full-fledged press agent publicist?
Like 78 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember what year it was. But one of my very first shows was in another David Merrick musical called The Baker's Wife.
Mm-hmm.
Which never came to Broadway, much to my chagrin, since
uh-huh.
I really loved it. And that was another show where David Merrick, I mean, wrought havoc, but the havoc did not produce a hit.
Right. And any favorite memories from that particular production?
Oh, they'll have to come to see my show.
Oh!
You don't work on a show like The Baker's Wife without coming away with many stories. In fact, Patty LuPone devotes an entire chapter
right.
to The Baker's Wife in her autobiography. So it's many tales worth telling.
And this is, of course, LuPone very early on in her career.
Oh, yes.
And
But she was still a force to be dealt with.
Oh, I can imagine. She's she's got that personality. That is
yeah.
that is Patty. It just is. You know, and you take yeah. her for who she is and respect the talent. And she's such a...
Look, she had... It was not a happy experience for her. And Topol was not nice to her. So,
right.
I mean, it's not Patty Kvetching. It's Patty telling the story as it happened.
Right. Right. And I do encourage people to pick up Patty's autobiography, because it's really good. It's
yeah.
very good. And if you can pick it up, I actually own the audiobook version on CD, which is fun because you're hearing Patty tell it in her own words.
And
her own attitude, exactly. So you get every Patty inflection when she's telling these stories.
Yes.
And it makes it that much more fun to listen to. Run us through some of the people you worked with and some of the shows you worked on that you can talk about.
It's one of the things, like, if you're a press agent on the show,
mm-hmm.
you can sometimes have a very intimate relationship with the people with whom you work.
Mm-hmm.
With Yul Brynner on The King and I, it was again another master manipulator. He knew we were doing what was turned out to be the 25th anniversary of the show's original opening. And at the time, Broadway was not particularly fond of revivals.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to make the show seem new and fresh. And he manipulated the media, and in fact, it was fresh. But the joy of that show is Yul Brynner was just my great teacher in so many aspects of life, not just press agentry and the theater, but, I mean, the man, he would make dinner for us on his walk, and he would start the walk during Small House with Uncle Thomas so that it would be ready to cook when the show was over.
Uh-huh.
So the timing of it was, I think of, Small House of Uncle Thomas, and I think of, the walk being set up, And the other part of working in the theater is that wonderful time between, when the actor gets to the theater to when the show begins, that period, so that you really get to know them, whether it was Lena Horne and just being a constant guest in her dressing room. I was You know, I look back on it and wonder, well, how did I handle like 5 or 6 other Broadway shows when I spent so much time in her dressing room? But then I remember when we were doing Nicholas Nickleby, I was at Nicholas Nickleby almost constant, well, from early morning till past midnight. And when the show finally closed, I was over at her, back in her dressing room, and she said, I know why you aren't visiting me anymore. I said, why? She said, Nicholas Nickleby. She knew I had other things on my plate.
Right. So. And it's, I'm glad you kind of mentioned those two shows, because those two shows were kind of, if I remember correctly from what you yourself have written and said, surprises, in the sense that, you know, the Lena Horne show wasn't necessarily expected to be a long-running thing, and Nicholas Nickleby was very iffy as to whether or not it would succeed on Broadway, and both turned out to be real surprises.
Huge surprises. The first preview of Lena Horne, The Lady and Her Music, was just not very good at all.
Mm-hmm.
And she crafted it in 2 weeks into something that was quite magnificent and took enormous chances with material. I just want to tell you a story about we did a press meet and greet at 890 Studios, Michael Bennett's studio at 19th and Broadway, and down the hall from where Lena Horne was rehearsing, a musical called Bring Back Birdie was also rehearsing, and that show starred Donald O'Connor and Cheetah Rivera, and our office handled Bring Back Birdie, but I personally was not involved with it, though I had a little bit of dealing with Cheetah Rivera. And I saw her on the press day when the press was supposed to arrive at around 11 in the morning, and Cheetah was not wearing any makeup, and her hair wasn't really, it was, you know, just as she woke up, kind of. And I said to her, look, I just want you to be aware that we're going to be having press come in, so if you want to just stay in your rehearsal room and not come out in the hallway, I just want to just give you a heads up. And she said, well, you know, they're working with Donald this morning. Do you need any help? And I thought, do I need any help? What do you mean? She said, well, I don't have anything to do this morning. Can I help you out? I said, well, how would you feel to greet the press at the elevator and bring them back to the room where Lena's rehearsing and hand out press releases? And she said, oh, I'd love to do that. That would be great. So the elevator doors went open, like it's at 11 o'clock, and the people, the press is coming out, and the photographers and reporters and TV crews, and there's a woman going, hi, I'm Cheetah. Welcome to Lena Horne's rehearsal. And she brings them down the hall. And that says so much about both ladies. I mean, at the end of the event, I said, I brought Cheetah into the room with Lena and said, I want to introduce you to the newest member of our press corps. And she was like, yeah. I told her what Cheetah did. They laughed, they giggled, they hugged. And that's the essence of working in the theater for me. It's like, isn't that just amazing that Cheetah Rivera would do it?
It is. Here was my response when you said that, told that story. It's surprising, but having worked in the theater for a long time myself, it's not, because theater people are just like that, so many of them. I mean, they're so giving, they're so willing to do whatever, they jump in a pinch, and Cheetah, you know, she's been around. By that point, she'd been around. She'd done everything. And it's like, she knows how theater works. She knows. I mean, it's still amazing that you've got her greeting the press. And I'm sure the press was like, what the hell? Cheetah Rivera's greeting us?
Yeah, it does. The fact is that, you know, you work with people who, like Cheetah Rivera, who clearly can fit smoothly into a crowd. Then you have someone like Yul Brynner, who would never do something like that.
Right.
I mean, that was, and he did marvelous other wonderful things. And I will just give you an example of something that I witnessed that he did that you wouldn't really understand unless you were working on the show. There was a little boy in the show who had played the youngest child in the and was then the kind of the highlighted person in child in March of the Siamese Children.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point during the run of the show, he got too big to play that part. And they asked him to, he could play an older child who's in the March of the Siamese Children, but he would not be a featured child anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very, very sad. and Ubrenner volunteered to talk to this little boy. And the dressing room door shut, and the little boy went in with Ubrenner, and about 10 minutes later, the little boy comes out with the biggest smile on his face. And his mother asked the little boy, like, well, what did Mr. Brenner say? And he explained that everybody in the show was important to the show's success, and that if he stayed a professional and he did his job, no matter what part he was given, that maybe one day he would play the crown prince. And if he continued to work in the theater and continued to develop his craft, maybe one day he would even one day play the king. And that's how he taught a little boy how to be a professional. And that's the essence of Yul Brynner that we do not hear about.
Right.
When I was a boy, world was better spot. What was so was so, what was not Now I'm a man, world have changed a lot. Something's nearly so, others nearly not. There are times I almost think I am not sure of what I absolutely know. Very often find confusion in conclusion I concluded long ago. In my head are many facts that as a student I have studied to procure. In my head are many facts of which I wish I was more certain. I was sure. Is a puzzlement. What to tell a growing son? What, for instance, shall I say to him of women? Shall I educate him on the ancient lines? Shall I tell the boy as far as he's able to respect his wives and love his concubines? Shall I tell him everyone is like the other, and the better one of two is really neither? If I tell him this, I think he won't believe it. And I nearly think I don't believe it either. When my father was a king, he was a king who knew exactly what he knew. And his brain was not the thing forever swinging to and fro and fro and to. Shall I then be like my father and be willfully unmovable and strong? Or is better to be right, or am I right when I believe I may be wrong? Shall I join with other nations in alliance? If allies are weak, am I not best alone? If allies are strong with power to protect me, might they not protect me out of all I own? Is a danger to be trusting one another? One will seldom want to do what other wishes. But unless someday somebody trusts somebody, there'll be nothing left on earth excepting fishes. There are times I almost think nobody's sure of what he absolutely knows. Everybody find confusion in conclusion he concluded long ago. And it puzzled me to learn that though a man may be in doubt of what he knows, very quickly will he fight, he'll fight to prove that what he does not no, is so. Oh, sometimes I think that people going mad. Sometimes I think that people not so bad. But no matter what I think, I must go living life. As leader of my kingdom, I must go forth. Be father to my children and husband to each wife, etc., etc., and so forth. If my Lord in heaven would have showed the way, every day I try to live another day. If my Lord heaven Buddha show the way. Every day I do my best for one more day. But ease a puzzlement.
So explain a little bit. I want to backtrack a little tiny bit, and that is just so people have an understanding. What exactly is the role of the publicist for a musical like this? Because I think people are familiar with, you know, on the surface they see all the end product and what a publicist ends up producing and generating, but what is the day-to-day job for a publicist on a show?
The day-to-day really changes from, is the show about to go into rehearsal, in rehearsal, what stage of it is it in? And I think that the part of the creativity part, well, it's creative all along, but the early part is, how do you create the image of what the show is? And remember that the press has used, over the years, I was just astonished that the press would say to me, well, can you send us some production photographs? And you'd say, well, production photographs don't exist yet. We're in rehearsal. I can show you costume sketches. I can show you set designs. But the pieces aren't coming together yet because that's why we're in rehearsal. And how are you describing the show? What is the one sentence used to describe what your show is? How do you make them excited about the show? What elements are in it that would make somebody go, oh yes, I want to see that versus I want to see that? And it's also putting in a layer of, what are you doing to tell the press about it so that they're exactly in the right place mentally and physically when they see the show? I used to call knickknacks, which were like a sort of like a guided tour of a show for the media before they saw the show. What background do they need? It's filling in the blanks, because you realize that when they go back to write their review, all they have basically are their notes in the playbill. So what else can you provide them with? Also things like writing a playbill. And the playbill is a map. And I have seen shows where the map helps the people seeing it, and there's sometimes where the map is not helpful. Do you tell people where it's set? Do you tell them what time the period it is set? Are there the production notes? If the production note is in the program, does it sound like an excuse, or does it sound like it's really helpful information?
Right.
All of these pieces go together. When do you distribute the pictures? I mean, don't give them away. God loves Scott Rudin. He only one picture of Bette Midler in Hello Dolly appeared before that production opened. It was all a surprise to people.
Oh, I know. And I was shocked at that.
The element of surprise is what it's all about.
Yes.
You don't let people see it before they see it.
Right.
That's the magic of it. When it unfolds and you go, I had no idea it was going to look like this.
Right. And it's funny that you brought that up, because, you know, following the business very closely as I do, you can set your calendar by it. Okay, this is the opening date, so by this date, we're probably going to see a bunch of production photos. We're going to see this. We're going to get this. But with Dolly, there was such a tight lid on everything that nothing was coming out. I mean,
well,
like,
that,
nothing.
That is brilliant producing.
Because it made everybody...
It opens, show the pictures, it's fine. It's,
right.
You know, going to need it.
Right. It was funny, because it looked as though there actually were production photos taken, and at one point Playbill Online posted them. I think it was like the day before the opening of Dolly, and they were only up for like an hour, and then they disappeared, because I think Playbill didn't realize they weren't supposed to put them up yet. So they immediately yanked them. And of course that got, and it, of course that could have been done on purpose, because the whole internet was chattering away about the disappearing production photos. You know, got everybody talking about it.
It's Scott Rudin doing vintage David Merritt.
Right.
Now, early on, you asked me, like, who other than the people? I should tell you, mention other people that I talk about in the show itself.
Mm-hmm.
Ethel Merman, Eartha Kitt, Sandy Duncan, Stephen Sondheim, Katharine Hepburn. And what I try to do in the show is largely not just to talk about them and the education I got from them, but I also impersonate them.
Oh, okay.
So I want to create... They are, in fact, characters. So whether you are very, very familiar with these people or do not have much familiarity with them, I create them as characters so that whether I told them to a group of high school kids who have no idea who they are or somebody who is a Broadway baby, they both get it.
Mm-hmm,
and when I've done it for high schools, the thing that really is thrilling is that afterwards they come and go, well, are these people on YouTube? Where can we see them? Because they don't know the people. They don't know Eartha Kitt. They don't know David Merrick, you know. And and how thrilling it is to be able to say to them, yes, if you can YouTube to your heart's content.
They're out there, yeah.
People, you know, they're all over the place.
Right. And how did you end up working with Ethel Merman?
Well, I didn't work with Ethel Merman. I had the great joy, really, really early on in my career, of having dinner with her. Because a friend of mine taught high school, and one of his students was Ethel Merman's granddaughter.
Mm.
So Ethel Merman invited my friend and his wife, and they were, I mean, beyond kind to ask Miss Merman if they could bring a guest to dinner. It was the thrill of having dinner with Ethel Merman and asking her the one question that I have always wanted to ask Ethel Merman. And my question to her was, tell me about creating Rose's Turn. So I hung on every word, and the story's in the show. That's as far as
that's
I
will amazing.
Go with that particular story. But to me, Rose's Turn is the number. And I never saw Miss Merman do Gypsy. So to me, it's just the sacred recording, the original cast album.
Yeah. And I also know that, talking a little bit more about Merrick, I know you joined 42nd Street right after opening, correct?
I was originally asked to do the show,
but
I was doing four other shows with four other producers, and I had known David Merrick, and I just thought, you know, of course I want to be the press agent of 42nd Street, but I think it's just nuts to do it when it's a huge Merrick musical having a tryout if you're doing four other brand new shows. And so I turned it down, and the show opens. Gower Champion famously dies on opening night, and then Merrick calls me up at 7:30 in the morning and says, how would you like to be the press agent of the biggest hit on Broadway? And I think he's joking, you know. I mean, the show's is legendary from opening night on. And it's, the adventure starts. I say, yes, I'll do it. And so I do it for another 8.5 years.
Oh, wow. You worked on that show. I didn't realize you worked on it that long. Wow.
Yeah, well, when you're... he fired the original press agent darn early in its run, let's put it that way. And I at least had worked with Merrick before, so I understood what I was getting into. I mean, he had lots and lots of rules around which to work. For example, if anyone left the show and had a replacement, I was not allowed to set up interviews with the replacements. You know, so think about, how do you sustain publicity for a show for 8 years?
I know that to
if
me.
You can't do interviews with the cast, but think about the fact that, you know, we did things like when 42nd Street moved from the Majestic to the St. James. We put the dimes on the sidewalk, and the cast danced from one to the theater to the other in full costumes. So that's how you sustain publicity.
Right.
And I remember, I mean, this caused no amount of consternation with me and the replacement casts, because they would be like, I mean, one of Joe
Right, because the show is the star. The show is the star, and in a way that is smart producing. You know, I mean, you can certainly advertise and continue the success of the show by touting who the replacements are, especially if they're big names. But you know, you can kind of see Merrick's logic of 42nd Street sells 42nd Street, and it should always be the show first.
Right, you know? That makes an enormous, that gives the press agent an enormous challenge.
Right,
because you know, what do you do for 8.5 years? And he was not one, even after his stroke, he was not one to sit back and just let it all happen.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But after his stroke, I kind of knew what David Merrick would want. And I would do it, everything in the spirit of David Merrick. So whether he was telling me to do it or not, his modus operandi was so much part of my muscle memory that I just was able to do it.
Now that we have had the rice and flowers, the knot is tied.
I can visualize such happy eyes. Close by your side.
The honeymoon in store is one that you'll adore. I'm gonna take you for a ride.
You go home and get your panties, I'll go home and get my scanties, and away we'll go. Ooh, off we're gonna shuffle, shuffle off the buffalo. Niagara in the sleeper, there's no honeymoon that's cheaper, and the train goes slow. Oh, off we're gonna shuffle, shuffle off the buffalo. Someday the stork may pay a visit and leave a little souvenir, just a little cute, what is it? But we'll discuss that later, dear. For a little silver quarter, we can have the pool. Turn the lights down low. Ooh, off we're gonna shuffle, shuffle off the buffalo.
So when did you finally end your run as a publicist?
1991.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a Broadway publicist, I moved on and did director of communications at La Jolla Playhouse.
Right.
Another set of adventures with shows like I am Thoroughly Modern Millie and I Am My Own Wife.
With Jefferson Mays, yeah.
Yeah.
So what was the last Broadway musical you did? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but I can tell you why I stopped wanting to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because I fell in love with a musical that was, I thought, so wonderful, even though I realized it had flaws. And the closing of it felt like the loss of a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And the musical was called Rags.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if Rags was not my last musical, it was definitely the last musical that I fell in love with that I worked on.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a bitter lesson of not falling in love that much with the show.
Mm-hmm.
I love the show. I love the music. I love Teresa Stratus. I was in Boston almost the entire run as we went through so many ramifications, a different director, a different choreographer. Teresa Stratus missing the opening week in Boston. I mean, it was full of trials and lots of errors, but I still loved it. And sadly, Teresa Stratus did not make the original cast album.
Uh-huh.
A beautiful album, but not what we had in the theater.
Right.
Particularly what we had at the Schubert Theater in Boston, not what we ended up with at the Mark Helen Show on Broadway.
Penny a tune, tunes from around the block, tunes from afar. Beautiful tunes, played by musicians who played for the Tsar. Penny a tune,
for a penny
a tune, empty your pockets and fill up our hats. Music from the shops and the cold water flats, all for a penny a tune.
All over the east side they're making a beat for quarter time in the air, for kiddies and grannies and tenement crannies working their fannies off there. They bring us the rhythm of Rivington Street for just a penny a tune. For sure, though, we sweat and we stitch. Where folks are poor, that's where music is rich. Music tonight and the long afternoon. Spirit to hear it from Sid's violin.
Oh, I got a boyfriend and his name is Ben. Ain't that a beautiful name? He's got this rich cousin and worked at Ben Dozen. Factory will make Ben the same. Someday he'll be boss there, I know it, and then he'll be coming for me. I don't know when, but it's gonna be soon.
Left a factory in Minsk to cross the sea, and look at me, I ain't come far.
A prince among men, my Prince Street tycoon.
But I'll find Bella here and make a family and never make another damn cigar.
The dreams of a hot afternoon. Play it again for Bella and Ben, and only a penny a tune.
Without apples, sweetest spices,
hey, you can't beat our prices.
it as a solo for Teresa Stratus. And Teresa invited Andy Gale, who was in the show, and me to the... She wanted to do an orchestra run-through of the show before she actually did it in the show. So Andy and I heard her do it solo the first time with an orchestra. And it was as thrilling an experience as one can have in the theater, because mm-hmm. it's a gorgeous song, and she did it extraordinarily well. And clearly, as a solo number, was going to be a showstopper.
Right. Well, and that the score for Rags is one of those real lost, I don't say lost because people aren't familiar with it, but it's one of those real gems that it's an unfortunate missed opportunity that the show
and
didn't become a hit.
Robert Sher, thank goodness, had it recorded. I mean,
right.
He produced it, and so it lasts, mm-hmm. and it will have many lives post-Broadway.
Right.
I mean, four performances is just pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
But let me just tell you about the second to the last performance, because it was really quite extraordinary. The show, we knew the show was going to be closing on a Saturday night. It plays a Saturday afternoon, and at the Saturday afternoon, Lonnie Price goes and makes a curtain speech and tells the audience that the show was closing that night. There were lots of seats available. The cast is going to go down to the TKTS booth, and if anybody in the audience would like to join the cast walking down to TKTS, they're invited to join, just to meet at the stage door.
Uh-huh.
And over 800 people
joined.
Now, in New York, you just can't have 800 people as a clump walk that much without
no,
it.
No.
You need something called, you know, like a parade, what do you call it, documentation?
Permit
you know,
or something.
Mm-hmm. Permit, right. Mm-hmm. Parade permit, which, of course, we didn't have. But the police were incredibly supportive, and it was like having 800 people work the line, as it were. I mean, people were saying, I don't care what you wanted to see tonight. You're going to see Rags. And people who had gone to the matinee bought tickets to see the show a second time that night. So it was an event that made the final performance so astonishing, because they were already fans in the audience.
Uh-huh.
How does that happen? That, you know, it had cult status while it was still running for four performances.
Uh-huh. And passionate, and people got passionate about that show.
Yes, and the cast and company were incredibly tight, and someone had the idea of having a Rags reunion of the cast and company, and it was set, and it was held the following Wednesday night, because the people in the cast didn't want to be with each other for less than a week.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It was a bonding of which, the likes of which I've never experienced before, and the fact that it happened on a famous flop is just extraordinary.
So let's jump real briefly, because we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I want to jump real briefly to your time at La Jolla, because you did go to La Jolla Playhouse, which, as most of us know, is a wonderful, wonderful local theater down in La Jolla, California, near San Diego, where a lot of great shows have come out of La Jolla over the years. And you brought up Thoroughly Modern Millie, so I wanted to kind of get your take on its initial run down in La Jolla, because I saw it twice down in La Jolla. You know, I was curious about seeing the show. And seeing how they had adapted the film, because the film is a lot of fun, even though I think it's relatively flawed in a lot of ways. It's still a very fun movie. But I was curious to see it. I also knew a couple of people in the cast, so I wanted to, you know, go down and support them and see them. But I still tell this story to people. It's hard to explain the energy that was coming off of that stage during that run. And the audience absolutely going out of their minds over Sutton Foster in that show.
Okay, well, there's three things that are going on there, okay? One is the fact that La Jolla Playhouse is a fully Broadway-sized stage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the audience only exceeds 500.
Right.
So it is intimate and big at the same time. So it's not like a show ever has to restage it after La Jolla when
right. UC San Diego, huh?
UCSD. And it was in one of their lecture halls. It was not in the theater, the Runsbrough. And the young woman who was playing Millie wasn't well. Uh-huh. And so they asked her understudy, Sutton Foster, to do it. And Sutton knew the choreography and the movement, but not the book and some of the lyrics. So she was holding the script. And there was no question for anyone who was in that room that day that we were watching The Birth of a Star.
Uh-huh.
It was, you couldn't not know that. And I remember saying to my assistant, who was not particularly theatrically oriented, said, you were never going to see the likes of this again. This is quite amazing. So, within a week, she had replaced the actress who was originally cast as Millie. And then there was a part in the script where it said, song goes here. And it was toward the end of the show when it was going to be the 11 o'clock number.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't exist yet.
Uh-huh.
And Jeanine Tresori and Dick Scanlon were at a piano that was in the lobby of the theater. And for us who worked at the Playhouse, the only bathroom was in the theater itself, not in the trailer where we had our offices. So if you went to the bathroom, you would actually pass the two of them at a piano writing a new song. And they were writing it very specifically for Sutton Foster because they knew that's the kind of voice they were writing it for.
Uh-huh.
And so day after day, the whole thing about like being out of town and people writing songs in hotel rooms, you know, and they were going, they're writing this song right in front of us. And all we have to do is like walk past them and see it happening. And the song was Gimme Gimme. And then we would see Sutton walking around with a recording of it so that she could learn the song. Then we were in the room while they added the orchestrations, which were by Ralph Burns at the time. I think it's his last show because I think he died before it actually came to Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw them put it into the show. And it was a showstopper.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
We watched the birth of the showstopper.
Right.
We heard about it, or we were like, oh yes, that all happened in that hotel room, and then all we get to see is the final result.
Right.
We were intimately involved with every single step of that number being created, and when you actually see it, and you go, oh my God, she has that, look at the costume she's wearing for it, look at the everything about it. I mean, it's just an amazing experience to watch a showstopper being created by people who know how to do it and customize it so specifically to a talent that they know who can deliver it.
Right, exactly.
A simple choice, nothing more. This or that, either or. Marry well, social world, businessman, clever girl, or pin my future on a green glass love. What kind of life am I dreaming of? I say, gimme, gimme. Gimme, gimme that thing called love. thing called love. I'm free now. Give me that thing called love. I see now, fly, dove, sing, sparrow. Give me Cupid's famous arrow. Give me that thing called love. I don't care if he's a nobody. In my heart, he'll be a somebody. Somebody to love me. I need it. Give me that thing called love. I want it. Here I am, Saint Valentine. My bags are packed. I'm first in line. Aphrodite, don't forget me.
Audience response by that point in the show is you felt like the roof was going to blow off the theater when she finished the song. When I saw
right.
it, I was
you
know, shocked.
She's also, you understand that, like, this is the first time she's starring in this show,
right?
So mm-hmm. she has the weight of the whole show, and she has to deliver a really big number after doing an incredibly difficult show.
Mm-hmm.
And technically it was more difficult in La Jolla than it was on Broadway. They actually made it a little bit easier for her. The transitions were easier after La Jolla. So she was really doing heavy lifting. So to do that number that late in the show and pull it off with no show of flagging of energy, mm-hmm. she's just in there 100%.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you also in the sense that everyone, because I when I went down to see it the first time, I talked to friends who were in the show after the show, and they told me how exciting everything had been and all the stuff that was going on, and we all were kind of in agreement. Talents like Sutton Foster do not come around very often. They just don't, and she is not your typical leading lady. I mean, she is of the old school. She's funny. She's goofy. She can sing. She can dance. She can act. She's got all of it. And I loved it so much that I brought friends down with me the next time, all of whom were big fans of the movie. And I remember, even at intermission, one of my friends who was a huge fan of the movie basically turned to me after at intermission and said, "Julie Andrews who? This is Millie. This is who I'm now going to always think of as Millie."
Well, I think the fact that they both have lasted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like the musical didn't eclipse the movie.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
both exist for very different reasons.
Right, right.
And so I think what was most thrilling about her performance in La Jolla was that her vulnerability showed. It was all coming at her very, very quickly. And at the time, there was no guarantee that she was going to do the show on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, the question was, I mean, you're doing this great big musical and you're going to hire this nobody, no famous nothing to be the rock upon which you're building the whole show. So there was never the sense of, yes, she's being, yes, we have made her a star and she's going on to Broadway. It was like, we've made you a star, but don't forget, you're a star in La Jolla. You are not a star on Broadway.
Right.
That could come, it might not come.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the shade of difference, because on Broadway, you know, she was a much more assured Broadway performer, but I don't think that vulnerability was ever there again.
Right. And I'm glad you said that, because she was
indomitable on Broadway.
Yeah.
I didn't sense for one second that Millie was not going to succeed.
Right. No, I agree with you. I'm glad you said that because I did see the show on Broadway also after it won the Tonys. And to be honest with you, I didn't enjoy it as much as I did in La Jolla. It still was big and entertaining and fun, but there was something missing from the La Jolla production.
But it's also in your head that you knew she was going to succeed
Right.
because you had already seen her succeed in
Yeah,
La Jolla.
true. That's
So
true.
you can't undo memory.
Right, of
And
course.
so she's going to be, she is going to be tougher. I mean, that just,
Yeah.
she's been through it. She can't undo that experience.
Right.
But you saw her when she was brand new at it, and it was a high wire
Yes.
act in La Jolla.
Yeah.
She wasn't so high wire in New York
Right.
because she had the assurance that she really could deliver the goods.
And she certainly has proven that she can.
Over and over and
Over and over and
over
over
again.
again. That's right. She's an
But if
amazing.
everyone's like, "Oh, can you spot star talent?" and you go, "Of course," I mean, it's no fine art. You just get it.
Right.
You see, you get it.
Right. Yeah. Someone steps on the stage and you immediately, if you've been around and seen a lot of theater, someone steps on stage, no matter how small their part is, and you go, "Ooh, wow. Who is this? Who is this person?"
Well, I mean, that's the joy of having seen tryouts in Philadelphia.
Right.
Because you would see people doing things like Linda Lavin doing You've Got Possibilities in It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. Who was this person? And she's not even playing she's not playing the lead. She's
Right.
not even playing the featured roles. She's kind of below the features. She's not even, what's her name? Not, what's the,
Oh, Patricia Moran?
Right, that not that character. She's even below that,
Right.
and she's playing Sydney. Who's Sydney? And
Mm-hmm.
she comes out and stops the show cold
Right.
with a song called You've Got Possibilities, and you go, well, there's a star,
Right.
big, but what is it? That whole thing about hearing the ruffle of the playbills for people looking
Yes,
at it to
exactly.
figure out who it is.
Right.
That is exactly what happens.
Right.
You only want two things. You want to who are they, and are they in the second act too?
Yeah, exactly. And I had the same in the same th I had that exact same experience when I saw Steel Pier on Broadway. And this little tiny petite blonde came out who was playing a really bitchy, very secondary character, like way secondary character. And she came out and I was like, who is this little tiny blonde? And where did she come from? And listen to that voice. And then in the second act, she's got this amazing number all of her own. And she's hitting notes that don't seem possible for someone who looks like her. And it was Kristen Chenoweth. And I, that's all I could talk about when the show was over. I was like, "Who? You got to see this Kristen Chenoweth person." The rest of the show isn't that great, but boy, you got to see her. She's
And
amazing.
then years later, you can say, "Yes, I saw her
Right,
win."
right.
And they do build on that, and you become a fan for life. That these are precious few, and I treat them as precious few. It's in any field when there's so few of anything. Yes, of course you hold them dear to your heart.
Yep.
And that's why they're great.
Well, we are now out of time for this edition of the Broadway Radio Show. But I want to thank Josh Ellis for taking some time to chat about his career and some of the shows that he worked on. And remind our listeners again when your show is coming up and the full title of the show and where they can get tickets.
Call my publicist, The Starry Education of a Broadway Press Agent. Directed by Gretchen Cryer,
The wonderful Gretchen Cryer.
the wonderful and fabulous Gretchen Cryer, United Solo Theater Festival at Theater Row in New York City, 212-239-6200. And if you sell out, they will add a performance. performance, so please get tickets now so I can add a performance.
Right, buy your tickets. And also, you can click on the link. There's going to be a website link here on the radio page, so you can click on that and also find out more information about Josh and also about finding information about buying tickets.
Thank you. I feel have been very privileged to have this life. It is wish fulfillment of the highest level, and I don't forget it for a second.
That's the best thing that you can say. It really is. If you've had a life that's been so fulfilling and has really given you, and you've given stuff too, which is the important thing. So that's, and it's wonderful that you're sharing your stories with people.
Well, I hope that people can come, because the stories make you, many old pros have come to see my show and they say, you remind me why I love this.
Mm-hmm.
All over again. And isn't that just a wonderful thing to have said? You know, that it just makes you fall in love with the theater all over again. And in a kind of way that whether you've been around for a long time or whether you're new at this, it's a pretty fabulous universe, this Broadway life. And I'm thrilled that I've had it.
Well, I am thrilled that you joined us here on the Broadway Radio Show.
Thank you so much. It was delightful to have met you during this time, Donald, and all the best.
You too.